This is Audible.
Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents Machine Translation by Thierry Poibeau, narrated by James Anderson Foster. 1. Introduction. In Douglas Adams's humorous saga, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, all one needs to do to understand any language is to introduce a small fish, the babblefish, into one's ear. This improbable invention is, of course, related to the idea of a universal translation device, and more generally to the key problem of language diversity and comprehension. The name of the fish is a transparent allusion to the biblical episode of Babel, when God scrambled language so that humans could no longer understand one another. A significant number of thinkers, philosophers, and linguists, and, more recently, computer scientists, mathematicians, and engineers, have tackled the question of language diversity. Moreover, they have imagined theories and devices intended to solve the problems caused by this diversity. Since the advent of computers after the Second World War, this research program has materialized through the design of machine translation tools. In other words, computer programs capable of automatically producing in a target language the translation of a text in a source language. This research program is very ambitious. It is even one of the most fundamental in the field of artificial intelligence. The analysis of languages cannot be separated from the analysis of knowledge and reasoning, which explains the interest in this field shown by philosophers and specialists of artificial intelligence, as well as the cognitive sciences. This brings to mind the test proposed by Turing in 1950. The test is successfully completed if a person dialoguing through a screen with a computer is unable to say whether her discussion partner is a computer or a human being. This test is foundational because developing an operational conversational agent presupposes not only understanding what the discussion partner says, at least to some extent, but also inferring from what has been said a relevant utterance that helps the whole conversation move forward. For Turing, if the test is successful, it means that the machine has a certain degree of intelligence. This question has fueled considerable debate, but we can at least agree on the fact that a robust conversational system would involve formalizing some mechanisms of understanding and reasoning. Machine translation involves different processes that make it at least as challenging as developing an automatic dialoguing system. The degree of understanding shown by the machine can be very partial. For example, the ELIZA system developed by Weizenbaum in 1966 was able to simulate a dialogue between a psychotherapist and his patient. The system, in fact, just derived questions from the patient's utterances. For example, the system was able to produce the question, "Why are you afraid of X?" from the sentence, "I am afraid of X." The system also included a series of ready-made sentences that were used when no predefined pattern seemed to be applicable. For example, "Could you specify what you have in mind?" or "Really?" Despite its simplicity, ELIZA had great success, and some patients really thought they were conversing with a real doctor through a computer. The situation is completely different when considering machine translation. Translation requires in-depth understanding of the text to be translated. Moreover, transposition into another language is a delicate and difficult process, even with news or technical texts. The aim of machine translation is not, of course, to address literature or poetry. Rather, the idea is to give the most accurate translation of everyday texts. Even so, the task is immensely difficult, and current systems are still far from satisfactory. However, and despite its limitations, from a more theoretical point of view, machine translation also makes us take a fresh look at old and widely investigated questions. What does it mean to translate? What kind of knowledge is involved in the translation process? How can we transpose a text from one language into another? These are some of the questions that are addressed in this book. This short book aims at providing an overview of the progress in machine translation since the Second World War. Some pioneers will be mentioned, but it is mainly the research implemented with computers that will be addressed. The content of the book is thus partly historical, since the main approaches to the problem will be presented in an intuitive manner. The idea is to make sure that the listener can understand the main principles without having to know all the technical details. Specifically, recent approaches based on the statistical analysis of very large corpora of texts will be presented, but these approaches are highly technical, and we will skip the mathematical details that are not necessary to grasp the overall idea. More technical books exist for those who are interested in the full details of the different approaches. The book begins with a presentation of the main problems one has to solve when developing a machine translation system. The journey continues with a quick overview of the evolution of machine translation, followed by a more detailed presentation of the history of the field, from its beginnings before the advent of computers to the most recent advances based on deep learning. Along the way, we will encounter all the main approaches developed since the field's beginning. Rule-based approaches, up to the ALPAC report and its consequences, and the advent of parallel corpora, which fueled research in the field after the 1980s, first through the example-based paradigm, then through the most popular statistical paradigm, along with its more recent developments, the segment-based approach, and the introduction of more linguistic knowledge to the systems. This book is not limited to a presentation of the main approaches to the problem. We will also address evaluation issues, which can be either manual or automatic, and the closing chapter will give some details about the commercial situation of the field, as well as its main actors worldwide. Although the domain is evolving quickly, including from a commercial point of view, we think it is important to address industrial issues since machine translation is now a key technology for several prominent domains, from defense to media and telecommunications. Lastly, we conclude with some observations on the current state of the field. 2. The trouble with translation. Before addressing machine translation, it is important to investigate the notion of translation itself. How do we proceed when we translate? What makes a translation a good translation? In the course of this chapter, we will hear that these questions are hard to answer and have already given rise to an abundant literature. In the second part of this chapter, we will investigate why understanding a sentence, something that is easy and natural for humans, is one of the most difficult things to do with computers, despite their incredible calculation power. What does it mean to translate? The answer to this question may seem obvious. To translate is to transpose a source language text into a target language text. However, one can easily see that this deceptively simple answer refers, in fact, to a dramatically complex problem. What does it mean to transpose a text? How do we go from a source language to a target language? How does one find equivalent expressions between two languages? Should the translation be based on words, chunks of words, or even sentences? And, more fundamentally, how can one determine what the meaning of a text or an expression is? Does everybody have the same understanding of a text? If not, how can this issue be handled in the translation process? As should be clear from the previous paragraph, translation is connected with a large number of questions dealing with linguistics, but also psychology or even philosophy when the nature of meaning is at stake. Instead of addressing these highly complex questions with no clear answer, it is probably more useful to take a step to the side and try to determine what the characteristics of a good translation are. What is a good translation? A first crucial issue when addressing translation is that no one knows how to formally define what constitutes a good translation. We should thus not expect to make much headway from this perspective, but at least some criteria can be found in the literature. Criteria for a good translation. The translation of a text should be faithful to the original text. It should respect the main characteristics of the original text, the tone and style, the details of the ideas, as well as its overall structure. The result should be easy to read in the target language, and it should also be linguistically correct, which means that a subtle process of reformulation must be used. Ideally, the reader should not realize he is reading a translation if he does not know the origin of the text, which implies that all formulaic and idiomatic expressions should be rendered appropriately. As a result, the translator must perfectly understand the text he has to translate, but he must also have an even better knowledge of the target language. This is the reason why professional translators usually only translate into their mother language so that they have a perfect understanding and knowledge of the expressions to be used to render the source text accurately. The inherent subjectivity of these criteria is undeniable, however. What is considered as a good translation by some readers may be a bad one according to another person. This situation frequently crops up when professional translators work with authors they are not familiar with, or when the translator does not know in what context his translation will be used. What is expected of a translation can vary radically depending on the clients, the era, the nature of the text, its usage, or even context. Technical texts are not translated in the same way as literary texts. A specific adaptation of the original text is necessary when the text concerns a world that is remote from the world of the reader in the target language. For example, if a Japanese text from the 12th century is translated into modern English, the translator has to choose between staying close to the original text or making use of paraphrasing to ensure comprehension, especially with historical contexts, unfamiliar events, etc. The tone and the style of a text are also highly subjective notions that are largely related to the language under consideration. As one can easily determine from this quick overview, all these subjective features make the evaluation of the task a difficult problem. Some pitfalls are, however, well known and frequently addressed in the literature on the topic. Word-for-word translation is not a good practice, since the result is often hard to understand and not idiomatic in the target language. Deceptive cognates and syntactic duplicates should, of course, be banished since they lead to nonsense. The French word achèvement should be translated as completion in English and not as achievement, for example. It is also well known that a translator should first read the whole text, or at least a large part of the text to be translated, so as to avoid local mistranslations. A good knowledge of the clients, context, and future use of the translated text can also help to adjust the translation to the target. Consequences for machine translation. From what we have heard so far, it is clear that translation is a complex process involving high-level cognitive and linguistic capabilities. A translator must be at ease with the two languages involved, and he must have special skills to reformulate a source language in a target language that does not have the same wording or the same structure. These kinds of skills are not directly available to machines. Artificial systems are still in their infancy from this point of view and are very far from the capacities of a human being when it comes to reasoning, inferring, and reformulating. To be able to reformulate a sentence, one must, of course, have a good command of the language itself, but one must also master the search for analogy between concepts, which is much more complicated than just equivalencies between words and expressions. Developers of artificial systems are aware of these limitations. Very few researchers have tried to develop machine translation systems for literary texts. Nearly everybody agrees that machine translation is a difficult task that is far from being resolved, and that only mundane texts, for example, news, technical texts, should be addressed. The idea is not to replace human translators, who are the only ones able to translate novels or poetry. Even technical texts pose specific difficulties since they employ a very technical vocabulary that has first to be introduced into the system in order to obtain relevant translations. The goal of machine translation is now considered mainly to be that of providing the user with some help and, in some professional contexts, enabling him to decide whether a human translator needs to be called on or not. The overall quality achievable by machine translation has also been a matter of much debate. The ultimate goal is to obtain a quality of translation equivalent to that of a human being. People agree that this is highly challenging and also hard to formalize, since the quality of a translation is related to the nature and complexity of the text to be translated. For a long time, machine translation used local techniques that could be compared, to a certain extent, to a word-for-word translation process, even if most systems now also take more complex expressions into consideration. Information at the text level is rarely taken into account, even though it is well known that the text can provide important information for the translation process. The tonality or the style of the text, for example, is always ignored. This kind of information is, in fact, too hard to formalize for automatic systems. In a way, even the sentence level is too complex for most current systems. It is generally assumed that these systems perform a sentence-by-sentence translation, which is true to a certain extent, but the translation process generally involves, in fact, fragments of sentences. The translation of a full sentence then consists in assembling the translations of these local fragments. It is therefore not surprising that machine translation sometimes provides strange results and quite often utter nonsense. Morphology, the analysis of the structure of words, and syntax, the analysis of the structure of sentences, are rarely taken into account, and this has particularly dramatic consequences for some languages. For example, some are said to be highly inflectional, which means that word forms can change depending on the grammatical function of the word in the sentence, subject, complement, etc. In this context, it is clear that an automatic process will not be able to provide the right word form in the target language without a proper syntactic analysis, that is, an analysis of the relative grammatical function of the different words in the sentence. Last but not least, one should understand why processing languages with computers is difficult, even when dealing with easier tasks than machine translation. A language has thousands of words with different surface forms, to dance, danced, dancing, different meanings and different structures, compounds, for example, round table, which generally designates an event and not an object, light verbs, for example, to take a shower, where take has little semantic content, and idioms or frozen expressions, for example, kick the bucket, the meaning of which has nothing to do with kick or bucket, make the task even more complex, since it is then necessary to spot complex expressions and not only isolated words. The following section aims at showing some of the issues at stake. Why is it difficult to analyze natural language with computers? Apart from the lack of information on the client, the context or the style of the text under consideration for translation, the main issue is related to the task itself. Processing natural languages, as opposed to processing formal languages, such as the programming languages used by computers, is difficult in itself, mainly because at the heart of natural language lie vagueness and ambiguity. Natural languages and ambiguity. Linguists as well as computer scientists have been interested ever since the creation of computers in natural language processing, a field also called computational linguistics. Natural language processing is difficult because, by default, computers do not have any knowledge of what a language is. It is thus necessary to specify the definition of a word, a phrase, and a sentence. So far, things may not seem too difficult. However, think about expressions like, isn't it, and won't with contraction apostrophes, US with abbreviational periods, and $80 with a symbol. It is not always clear what is a word and how many words are involved in such expressions, and not so different from formal languages, which are also made of words. The main difference lies in the fact that every word and every expression of a given natural language can be ambiguous. Let's take some famous examples, such as, "The chicken is ready to eat," or "There was not a single man at the party." These are textbook examples and may seem a bit far-fetched. However, they illustrate some well-known problems in language processing. In the first example, should one give the chicken something to eat, or is it the chicken that is ready to be eaten? In the second example, does the speaker mean that there were no men at the party, or does he mean that all the men there were married? These sophisticated examples should not mask the fact that ambiguity is in fact pervasive and is also part of the most mundane words and expressions. Just in these two examples, we can remark that chicken can refer to an animal or a kind of meat, but also a coward. A party can designate, according to WordNet, an organization to gain political power, a group of people gathered together for pleasure, a band of people associated temporarily in some activity, an occasion on which people can assemble for social interaction and entertainment, or even a person involved in legal proceedings. Party can also be a verb for have or participate in a party, etc. One answer to this problem is just to record all these different meanings in a dictionary, and this in a way already exists since we mentioned, for example, WordNet, a lexical database that can be used by humans as well as by computers. However, one quickly realizes that this is not a working solution, since once all these meanings have been stored in the dictionary, the problem is then to find a way to choose the right meaning of each occurrence, that is to say, for each word used in context. A normal dictionary usually contains around 50,000 to 100,000 entries, that is, different words, that can in turn generate more surface forms or words as they are found in texts. For example, texts is not a dictionary entry since it is just a surface form of the word text. Texts is the plural of text and thus is supposed to be known by the end user. This point of departure is assumed by nearly all dictionaries made for normal human perusal. In a dictionary, only the singular is stored for nouns and adjectives, and the infinitive for verbs. The dictionary form for a word is usually called a lemma. In English, the number of surface forms is limited, but the problem is worse for a language like French. For other languages like Finnish, the theoretical number of surface forms is huge and could even be considered infinite since the language has at least 12 cases and lots of suffixes and particles that can be combined in various ways. Trying to store all these forms in a dictionary is probably not a good idea. What makes things even more difficult is that to decide on the meaning of a word or an expression, does party here mean an organization to gain political power or a group of people gathered together for pleasure, one has to take context into account. But the context itself is generally ambiguous, leading to a potentially unresolvable problem. Moreover, it has been demonstrated that word senses are not mutually exclusive, and that word usages often fall between dictionary definitions. This is one of the main consequences of the pervasive vagueness of languages. What may seem paradoxical is that humans who cannot process numbers as fast or as accurately as computers are in fact very good at handling these kinds of problems. Most of us do not see any ambiguity in most sentences, even when there are thousands of meanings that could possibly be considered. This aspect of language complexity was simply not grasped by most of the early researchers in the domain, or, to be more exact, this complexity was largely underestimated. The way language is processed, and more specifically the way an utterance is understood, remains largely obscure, even nowadays in the era of neuroimaging. Understanding seems to be natural, direct, and largely unconscious. It is highly doubtful that all possibilities are considered in order to obtain a semantic representation of a sentence. Thanks to the communication context, the brain probably directly activates the right meaning without even considering alternate solutions. A parallel has sometimes been proposed with the Necker cube, the representation of a cube seen in perspective with no depth cue. The drawing is ambiguous in that no cue makes it possible to determine which side of the cube is in front and which side is at the back. However, it was noticed by Necker and others before him that humans naturally select one of the representations so that it makes sense and is coherent with the image of a cube in nature. Both interpretations, that is to say, two different cubes can be seen alternately, but they cannot both be considered simultaneously, since this would violate predefined conceptions embedded in the brain. One can also think about Escher's asymmetrical drawings that take advantage of quirks of perception and perspective. These images are largely based on representations that violate our preconceived representations of space. These examples should remind us that the brain is able to interpret and sometimes correct perceptions in accordance with predefined schemas. Without going into too many details, this theory is also in line with the notion of gestalt, which refers to the idea that the brain interprets a whole from its parts and a part from the whole. Applied to language, this means that the meaning of a word is largely determined by the larger context, which itself depends on the meaning of the words it is composed of. There is a dynamic co-construction of interpretation in the brain that is absolutely natural and unconscious. Consequences for machine translation. We have heard in this chapter that the main issue for natural language processing is ambiguity. It is simply difficult to determine the meaning of a word. Meaning depends on context, but the notion of context is itself also vague and ambiguous. We should add that determining the number of meanings per word, what is generally called word sense, is also an open issue, since from one dictionary to another, the number of word senses differs. Some dictionaries are more precise and contain a more fine-grained description of meaning, while others prefer to limit the number of senses per word, depending on their conceptual choices and on their intended readership. Despite these issues, it has been generally assumed that in order to produce high-quality translations, one must first provide a precise and accurate description of the meaning of sentences. Advances in machine translation were then linked to the progress made in text understanding, which largely drove the field for several years, as we will hear in the following chapters. However, these hypotheses are called into question. Statistical approaches can make use of large quantities of text available on the web and calculate possible equivalencies between language without using any predefined dictionaries or high-level formalisms. In subsequent chapters, we will discuss how accurate these models are and to what extent they avoid or integrate semantic information. Artificial and natural systems. A much debated question in the field of machine translation is the extent to which artificial systems should reproduce the strategies used by humans for translating. In other words, can we learn something from observing the working practices of professional translators? This is another hard question, and the first thing to stress is that we do not know much about the cognitive processes involved in the translation task. Moreover, translation strategies probably vary largely from one translator to another. It is clear that translating requires going beyond the simple word-for-word approach, as we have already heard, but it is debatable whether professional translators systematically do a deep syntactic and semantic analysis of the sentence to be translated. It is, for example, clear that professional interpreters doing on-the-fly speech translation
often translate semi-autonomous groups of words without having heard the full sentence, especially in the case of a long sentence. This approach can be compared to that of statistical systems that do not perform a deep analysis of the sentence to be translated, but identify groups of words that work together. The parallel is not completely exact, since interpreters always select groups of words that are relatively autonomous in the sentence, generally full phrases, whereas a statistical analysis will extract any regular group of words without relying too much on syntactic constraints. However, as already said, statistical systems are very good at recognizing multi-word expressions, compounds, idioms, etc., that are perceived as single units even by humans, as the psychoanalysis of language shows. Recent experiments have reinforced this point of view, since even high-level syntactic structures can correspond to regular patterns. These structures are sometimes called constructions, specific syntactico-semantic structures registered as such in our brains, or prefabs, like a home made of prefabricated elements that can be quickly assembled to obtain a modular construction. In this framework, syntax is not as prominent as in traditional approaches. The sentence is seen as an assemblage of prefab units, or, put differently, an assemblage of complex sequences stored as such in the brain. The analysis is thus simpler, since, if this hypothesis is correct, the brain does not really have to take into account each individual word, but has direct access to higher-level units, reducing both the overall ambiguity and the complexity of the sentence understanding process. Hence, it is not certain that interlingual systems, based on complete understanding and abstract representation of sentences, are the most realistic ones from a cognitive point of view, contrary to what has long been believed. We will come back to these issues once we have described in detail the different approaches considered in the domain. 3. A quick overview of the evolution of machine translation. In this chapter, we examine the different possible approaches and the main tendencies observed in the domain of machine translation since its beginnings. It is important to have an idea of the main challenges and the main evolutions of the domain before diving into more detail. Each of these approaches will then be detailed in the following chapters. Rule-based systems, from direct to interlingual approaches. Different approaches and different techniques have been used for machine translation. For example, translation can be direct from one language to the other, that is, with no intermediate representation, or indirect, when a system first tries to determine a more abstract representation of the content to be translated. This intermediate representation can also be language-independent, so as to make it possible to directly translate one source text into different target languages. Each system is unique and implements a more or less original approach to the problem. However, for the sake of clarity and simplicity, the different approaches can be grouped into three different categories, as most textbooks on the topic do. 1. A direct translation system is a system that tries to produce a translation directly from a source language to a target language with no intermediate representation. These systems are generally dictionary-based. A dictionary provides a word-for-word translation, and then more or less sophisticated rules try to reorder the target words so as to get a word order as close as possible to what is required by the target language. There is no syntactic analysis in this kind of system, and reordering rules apply directly to surface forms. 2. Transfer systems are more complex than direct translation systems, since they integrate some kind of syntactic analysis. The translation process is then able to exploit the structure of the source sentence provided by the syntactic analysis component, avoiding the word-for-word limitation of direct translation. The result is thus supposed to be more idiomatic than with direct translation, as long as the syntactic component provides accurate information on the source and on the target language. 3. The most ambitious systems are based on an interlingua, which is more or less formal representation of the content to be translated. Extensive research has been done on the notion of interlingua. Fundamental questions immediately arose, such as, how deep and precise should an interlingua be so as to provide a sound representation of the sentence to be translated? Instead of developing a completely artificial language, which is known to be a very complex task, English is often used as an interlingua. But this is in fact quite misleading, since the representation is then neither formal nor language independent. It is thus better to speak of a pivot language, or simply a pivot, when the interlingua is a specific natural language. English, in most cases, as we have just heard, but Esperanto and other languages have also been used in the past. In this context, when translating from language A to language B, the system first tries to transfer the content of A to the pivot language before translating from the pivot to the target language B. These three kinds of approaches can be considered to form a continuum, going from a strategy that is very close to the surface of the text, a word-for-word translation, up to systems trying to develop a fully artificial and abstract representation independent of any language. These varying strategies have been summarized in a very striking figure called the Vauquois Triangle, from the name of a famous French researcher in machine translation in the 1960s. Direct transfer, represented at the bottom of the triangle, corresponds to word-for-word translation. In this framework, there is no need to analyze the source text, and in the simplest case, a simple bilingual dictionary is enough. Of course, this strategy does not work very well, since every language has its own specificities, and everybody knows that word-for-word translation is a bad strategy that should be avoided. It can, nevertheless, give some rough information on the content of a text, and may seem acceptable when the two languages considered are very close, same language family, similar syntax, etc. Researchers have from the very beginning also tried to develop more sophisticated strategies to take into account the structure of the languages at stake. The notion of transfer rules appeared in the 1950s. To go from a source language to a target language, one needs to have information on how to translate groups of words that form a linguistic unit, an idiom or even a phrase. The structure of sentences is too variable to be taken into account directly as a whole, but sentences can be split into fragments or chunks that can be translated using specific rules. For example, adjectives in French are usually placed after the noun, whereas they are before the noun in English. This can be specified using transfer rules. More complex rules can apply to structures like je veux qu'il vienne. I want him to come, where there is no exact word-for-word correspondence between the two sentences. I want that he comes is not very good English, and je veux lui devenir is simply ungrammatical in French. The notion of transfer can also be applied to the semantic level in order to choose the right meaning of a word depending on the context. For example, to know whether a given occurrence of bank refers to the bank of a river or to a money-lending institution. In practice, this is a hard problem if done manually, since it is impossible to predict all the contexts of use of a given word. For exactly the same reason, this quickly proved to be one of the most difficult problems to solve during the early days of machine translation. We will hear in the following chapters that, more recently, statistical techniques have produced much more satisfactory results, since the problem can be accurately approached by the observation of very large quantities of data, the kind of thing computers are very good at, and humans less so, at least when they try to provide an explicit and formal model of the problem. Last but not least, another family of systems is based on the notion of interlingua, as we have already heard in the previous section. transfer rules, by definition, always concern two different languages, that is, English to French in our examples so far, and thus need to be adapted for each new couple of languages considered. The notion of interlingua is supposed to solve this problem by providing a language-independent level of representation. Compared to transfer systems, the interlingual approach still needs one analysis component to go from the source text to the interlingual representation, but then this representation can give birth to translations into several languages directly. The production of a target text from the interlingual representation format, however, requires what is called a generation module. In other words, a module able to go from a more or less abstract representation in the interlingual format to linguistically valid sentences in the different target languages. Interlingual systems are very ambitious, since they need both a complete understanding of the sentence to be translated and accurate generation components to produce linguistically valid sentences in the different target languages. Moreover, we heard in the previous chapter that understanding text is, to a great extent, an abstract notion. What does it mean to understand? What information is required so as to be able to translate? To what extent is it possible to formalize the comprehension process given the current state of the art in the domain? As a result, and despite several years of research by several very active groups, interlingual systems have never been deployed on a very large scale. The issues are too complex. Understanding a text may potentially mean representing an infinity of expressed and inferred information, which is, of course, highly challenging and simply goes beyond the current state of the art. The revolution of statistical machine translation systems. The classification of machine translation systems provided in the previous section is challenged by new approaches that have appeared since the early 1990s. The availability of huge quantities of text, especially on the Internet, and the development of the capacity of computers have revolutionized the domain. Most current industrial machine translation systems, and especially the most popular ones, Google Translation, Bing Translation, are based on a statistical approach that does not completely fit into the previous classification. These systems are not primarily based on large bilingual dictionaries and sets of handcrafted rules. The first statistical systems implemented a kind of direct translation approach, since they tried to find word equivalences between two different languages by directly looking at very large amounts of bilingual data, initially coming from specialized international institutions and, more recently, for the most part, harvested on the web. Statistical approaches are now considerably more precise. They no longer deal with isolated words, but are now able to spot sequences of words, such as compounds, idioms, frozen expressions, or just regular sequences of several words that need to be translated as a whole. The most recent approaches even try to tackle the problem directly at the sentence level. It should be noted that these systems have their own internal representations that are generally not directly readable by a human being. It is thus necessary to consider the nature of these representations. To what extent do they render semantic information? Can we draw any parallel between this approach and the way humans handle language? The success of these systems lies in the fact that they are able to grasp regular equivalencies between languages, but also more or less frozen sequences in a text, based on a purely statistical analysis. Since meaning is not something formally defined but corresponds to the way words are used, a purely statistical approach can be quite powerful in discovering regularities and specific contexts of use. However, for a long time, and in most available online systems still now, equivalencies were calculated at a local level and involved fragments of text that often overlap. The main difficulty was then to make sense of all these fragments and equivalencies, Statistical systems then had to deal with a multiplicity of fragments that had to be assembled to give birth to a well-formed sentence. These fragments may provide contradictory information and are thus not fully compatible. The task could be compared to assembling a jigsaw puzzle using a set of pieces coming from 10 different puzzles. In Chapter 12, we give a brief overview of the most recent approaches based on deep learning, a new and, again, completely different paradigm which attempts to tackle the problem directly at the sentence level. Deep learning approaches thus have the potential to give considerably more precise results. A quick historical overview. The history of machine translation can be summarized as follows. Until the 1940s, some researchers thought about the problem of the automation of translation, but these pioneering studies were not taken up since it was not possible to develop and test them in practice. From the 1940s to the mid-1960s, with the advent of the first computers, several teams developed operational machine translation systems. Expectations concerning the development of the field were high. The approaches used were sometimes rather naive, but some researchers already imagined more fundamental approaches, some of which were seminal and rediscovered some years later. In 1965 to 1966, the ALPAC report, commissioned by the American funding agencies, had a dramatic impact on the field. The conclusions of the report were highly negative, describing the research done up to then as flawed and useless. Funding that was already dramatically shrinking gradually petered out. However, one should note that the report also stressed the need to develop more fundamental research combining computers and linguistics so as to allow the field to make more progress in text understanding and, more fundamentally, in parsing and in automatic semantic analysis. The following years, up until the end of the 1980s, were not very productive for machine translation, especially in the Anglo-American world. New groups nevertheless emerged in Europe and other countries. On the other hand, research in computational linguistics was blooming during the same period for speech as well as for written text. The 1960s and 1970s saw major developments in parsing, automatic syntactic analysis, semantics, and text understanding, for example, as suggested in the 1966 ALPAC report. The 1990s saw the advent of a new approach based on statistics and very large bilingual corpora. This trend clearly derived from a series of seminal papers written by a research group working at IBM in the late 1980s and early 1990s. These papers had a considerable impact along with the development of statistical and empirical approaches in natural language processing. The most popular translation systems nowadays, Google and Bing Translation, are all based on a variant of this approach. Recently, the very high-level demand for automatic translation over the web has also had the effect of reinstating machine translation at the heart of the field of computational linguistics after several decades in purgatory. A new approach based on deep learning is also completely revolutionizing the field since the mid-2010s. We now need to examine these different stages in more detail so as to better understand the approaches and their main challenges, as well as the limitations of each system. 4. Before the advent of computers. Machine translation is closely related to the advent of computers, allowing scientists to imagine a fully automatic translation process. At the same time, we should not forget that very early on, there were also philosophical, religious, and scholarly speculations about the possibility of automating translation that are important for the history of the field. Eventually, the first half of the 20th century saw the design of prototypes that prefigured some of the systems developed since the 1950s. The question of universal languages. A long and relevant tradition from this perspective is the quest for a universal language. If such a language were to exist, it would by nature eliminate the need for translation, given its universal nature. More realistically, one could think of an artificial language that would facilitate translation between existing languages. Needless to say, this is a key point for machine translation. Different groups have explored this idea of a universal language. The systems developed on this basis are commonly called interlingual, as heard in the previous chapter. A long tradition. In the Western tradition, the ancients often refer to an Adamic language, that is, a hypothetical and universal proto-language spoken by humanity before the story of Babel. This aroused the interest of Leibniz, even if he was also among the first to partially abandon this tradition, since he believed it was impossible to rediscover this Adamic language from our modern languages. He nevertheless developed a project intended to eliminate ambiguity in languages by defining a new artificial language that no longer referred to any supposed Adamic tradition, for the purpose of solving various problems such as moral, legal, or philosophical dilemmas. Descartes is often cited along with Leibniz in this respect, since he was also interested in the idea of a universal language and its relationship with existing languages. Witness the following passage about a proposal for a universal language. If someone put into his dictionary a single symbol corresponding to Amir, Amare, Feline, and each of the synonyms, a book written in such symbols could be translated by all who possessed the dictionary. This passage greatly inspired machine translation pioneers, since Descartes' proposal aimed to replace words with unambiguous codes, symbols corresponding to numerical codes that are independent from the languages considered. Symbols replace words in Descartes' proposal. In the wake of these proposals, several attempts to develop a numerical dictionary emerged at the end of the 17th century in Europe. A numerical dictionary is a dictionary in which a specific number, an identifier, is associated with each word or concept. Those who attempted the task include Cave Beck in 1657, Johann Joachim Becher in 1661, Athanasius Kircher in 1663, and John Wilkins in 1668. Hutchins mentions that Becher's dictionary was republished in Germany in 1962 as On Mechanical Translation, a coding attempt from 1661. Also worth mentioning in France are Joseph de Memieux, inventor of the term passigraphy in 1797, which refers to a style of writing or universal notation system, and Armand Charles Daniel de Fermat's Paris, who developed such a system in 1811. The main application was the encoding and decoding of messages, essentially for military needs. However, it is important to refrain from seeing these initiatives as direct precursors of machine translation. Leibniz's and Descartes' essentially aimed to solve philosophical, logical, and moral problems. While they addressed questions of language and translation in their writing, their research by no means supported the idea of automatic translation, though the correspondence between Mersenne and Descartes regularly mentioned the topic of translation. Leibniz's and Descartes' work, as well as the coding systems that followed them, were sources of inspiration for various researchers, and are often cited in the writings of the pioneers of machine translation, but they do not appear to have ever been used for the development of real systems. Artificial languages. The notion of universal language brings to mind artificial languages, of which Volapük and Esperanto are the most well known. Volapük is an artificial language invented in 1879 by Johann Martin Schleyer, 1831-1912, while Esperanto was invented by Ludwig Leitzer Zamenhof, 1859-1917, with the goal of facilitating communication between people with different mother tongues. Zamenhof published his project called Lingvo Internatia, International Language, in 1887, under the pseudonym of Doctoro Esperanto, Doctor Who Hopes, the name by which the language became popular afterwards. All these projects emerged at the end of the 19th century in order to facilitate trade and peaceful cooperation between populations. Although these projects resulted in relatively advanced proposals with vocabularies and grammar systems, they have rarely been actively used for machine translation. Esperanto was used during the 1980s in the European Distributed Translation Language Project and within the Fujitsu Company in Japan, but these two projects were not completed. Artificial languages thus remain as a source of inspiration more than a resource actually used in automatic translation systems. One reason is probably that Esperanto remains a language designed for humans, Esperanto being itself based on various existing European languages. It does not have the characteristics of a language intended to be directly manipulated by computers. During the 1990s, the Universal Networking Language Project aimed to develop such an artificial language to be used directly by computers, but it also remains to date relatively little used. The development of mechanical translation systems between the two world wars. During the 1930s, two researchers devised mechanical systems oriented toward multilingual dictionaries and semi-automatic translation. Artsrunis' Mechanical Brain. The first attempt was the work of Georges Artsruni, a French engineer of Armenian origin who had completed his studies in Russia before emigrating to France in 1922. In July 1933, he filed a patent application for a mechanical brain. It was not so much a predecessor of modern computers as a machine to store and retrieve various types of information automatically. Two prototypes were built, probably between 1932 and 1935, and aroused great interest during public demonstrations. The machine even received a Grand Prix at the 1937 Universal Exposition in Paris. Another prototype was built, but never completed. The two existing models are stored at the Musée des Arts et Métiers in Paris. In the late 1930s, various organizations handling large amounts of information showed considerable interest in this machine. In his patent, Artsruni mentions that his machine could automate the consultation of railway schedules, telephone directories, and the search for words in dictionaries. Nevertheless, World War II prevented these contracts from succeeding. Finally, the emergence of computers after the war made these purely mechanical machines obsolete. Artsruni's system was not specifically dedicated to translation, though the inventor stressed from the beginning that this field was one of the most promising. The machine could store linguistic data, that is, simple words, in different languages on a simple strip of paper. Each word was encoded in a unique way thanks to a set of perforations along the paper strip, according to the principles of punch cards. A keyboard was used to indicate to the machine the sought-after word, and it could then automatically find the corresponding translations from the coding strip. The system did not allow Artsruni to go any further. He was not a linguist and never addressed the difficulties of machine translation. But his archives clearly demonstrated that he was one of the first to invent a completely automatic system based on multilingual dictionaries. He also thought of fairly realistic uses for his machine. For example, telegrams written in an elliptical style that would fit well with a word-for-word translation. Artsruni also planned to directly store more complex linguistic units, such as compound words, for his machine. The only limit was the time and effort needed to encode the data. Smirnov-Troyansky's Assisted Translation Environment. Pyotr Petrovich Smirnov-Troyansky, 1894-1950, who worked as a professor in Russia, filed a patent for a machine that would select and code words for translation between several languages. The machine was probably never developed as a prototype. Smirnov-Troyansky invented a workspace that, to a certain extent, was close to Artsruni's machine. A mechanism specified a word to the machine, which was then capable of presenting translations for various available languages. Smirnov-Troyansky's invention was only concerned with translation, unlike the machine developed by Artsruni. What makes Smirnov-Troyansky's invention remarkable is that it goes beyond the simple coding of words and their translation. He imagined a system of 200 primitives capable of representing the function of a word in a sentence in order to generate the correct translation in the target language. Smirnov-Troyansky was interested